My great pleasure to introduce Mike from Brunswick Barrel. He'll be our speaker tonight, and make him feel welcome.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
And,
speaking of Richmond, I hear somebody here from Richmond. I was at a meeting there Monday night called the Outlaw Safe Crackers Group. It was awesome. Gotta love a meeting that calls itself the Outlaw Safe Crackers Group. I've never been to an AA meeting in this room. However, a friend of mine in the program, a fellow AA, her son was a member of the other fellowship, and he celebrated a couple anniversaries in this room, and I attended that. Sad to say, he's no longer with us. He didn't make it. But this room has a good feel to it. It's good to see so many people here on a Friday night, in here staying sober instead of out there getting crazy and getting locked up and breaking hearts and all that kind of stuff. Dave asked me to speak a couple of months ago, and I haven't seen or heard from him since, so I wasn't sure. I thought I might get here, and they'll say, "Who are you? Dave who?" But anyway, so I'm glad you were halfway expecting me. My sobriety date's February 24th, 1978, and I was told if I never forgot that date, that I'd never have to memorize another one. Now, that doesn't mean I'm going to fall over drunk if I forget the actual date that I came to AA, but what it does mean is if I forget where I came from, I'm going back. It's just that simple. I've seen people with more time than me return to drinking, and it's ugly. It's really, really ugly. Humility is one of those things we talk a lot about in AA, you know, like the more you have of it, the better. But if you think you have it, you don't. And if you don't have it, you know, then you probably do. And I don't know about all that. But I know this much. I know that there's a minimum requirement of humility for this thing to work. And we hear a lot of good definitions of humility. We hear to seek and do God's will for sure, to remain teachable. That's a good one. But the one that works best for me is the recognition of the need for God in my life. The recognition of the need for God in my life. And since I ain't getting any eyeball-to-eyeball interviews with God, y'all are it. You're the local reps. So that's how this thing works. The God of my understanding works through you people. And every time I come to an AA meeting, I'm telling everybody in the room, I need you. And I don't kid myself about that for a second. So I don't care how long I've been sober. In fact, I'm going to tell y'all, some people in here may be surprised to hear this. Some other people are going to say, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. But I was taught early on, it says, don't be impressed with how much time somebody has in the program. Time of itself doesn't mean a thing. It doesn't mean anything. Now, clearly you've probably been doing something right if you've been sober a long time. But what I was taught was to watch the action. Always watch the action. Now, I know people have been sober 25, 30 years. I wouldn't ask them for directions to the 7-Eleven. That's just the truth. And I know some other people have been sober just a couple of years that I would bare my soul to them. And the difference is because they're living this thing. Anybody can memorize words out of the book. Anybody can quote pages at you and all that kind of stuff. And that sounds really great. And it's good to know the book. It's good to love the book and all of that. But that doesn't impress me. That doesn't impress me. What impresses me is how you act, how you behave. You can learn a lot about somebody. You know, they'll be talking, oh, they're Mr. or Miss AA in the meeting. They're just all full of spirituality. They're just helping everybody, you know, running up to the newcomer in the meeting. And then outside of the meeting, you go out and get something to eat with them, and they treat the waitress like crap. You know, you can learn a lot about somebody that way. So I've never been impressed with how much time somebody has in the program. I'm impressed with the people who are living this thing. That's what makes a difference. Now, is this a young people's meeting? Is this young? Okay. Well, clearly I'm not young, so I don't know what Dave asked me, but I did get sober. Yeah, I was 24 years old when I sobered up. I'm 62 now, so you don't have to do the math. And trust me when I tell you, when I came in, nobody was coming up to me and saying those things that a lot of young people in AA have to endure, the stupid stuff you have to hear, like, oh, it's so good to see you young people come in. You don't have to go through what we went through. Well, I tell you what, I want to punch somebody in the mouth if they said that. But nobody was saying anything like that to me. They were saying things like, man, you're coming in the best way possible. You got nowhere to go but up. It was true. It was true. I'd have never lived to be an old alcoholic, and I know the people in this room understand that. I know people in this room understand that. I'd have never lived to be an old alcoholic. I hear these guys talking about drinking 35, 40 years. I'm thinking, there ain't no way in the world you were going at it like I was. There's just no way. It's not possible. It's just not possible. I'd have never lived to be an old alcoholic. And so in this room, I feel like that's okay when I say I got sober when I was 24 years old. Sometimes I get some sideways looks from some old people, and I just feel like, yeah, there you go. You're still doing it. They're still doing it. But here I feel comfortable. I was raised in an alcoholic home, and when I say that, I'm not saying that like like I'm looking for a little sympathy or a little, because you know where you can find that in AA. They told me where I could find sympathy when I got to AA. They said it's in the dictionary between Shinola and syphilis, and I clean that up a little bit more, you know. And I'm not saying it's like, and that's why I'm an alcoholic, because I was raised in an alcoholic home. That's not why I'm saying it. It's just my story. It's just I was born into what the big book refers to as the strange world of alcoholism. I never saw any normal drinking. I never did any normal drinking. My parents were good people. They were good people who loved their children. But when cunning, baffling, and powerful is in the house, there can be no peace. There can be no peace. And there was no peace in that house. I believe as a kid, I don't think I ever got a good night's sleep. I used to just lay awake in bed at night and I'd hear all this arguing and yelling and biting and screaming. And every time I'd hear a door slam, I'd flinch. And every time I'd hear some glass break, I'd flinch. And every time I'd flinch, I'd get a little sicker and a little sicker. I felt everything and I understood nothing. I was just like this inside, just wound up like this. Years later, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said, you know, drinking's but a symptom. There's deeper underlying causes. It was like, well, no kidding, Sparky. I hope you got more for me than that. I've been knowing that. We might be sick, but we ain't stupid. I knew there was something plenty wrong with me before I ever took a drink. I was way sick before I ever took a drink. I can remember being exposed to the power of alcohol at a very early age. My parents were both in the Army, and they had met during World War II overseas, and they were medical people. And they were on, like, I guess what you would call like a mass unit. And we all know that the combatants suffer a great deal. But you know what? The people who pick up the pieces, suffer a lot too. And I can remember years into my sobriety, my oldest sister had some letters. My parents were together on a unit for a while, and then they were separated. And they wrote letters to each other. And I remember reading some of the letters my mother had written to my father. And instead of seeing my mother, the alcoholic, I saw a young woman in her early 20s, an Army nurse, who was witnessing the horrors of war. And so there was a reason why she was wound up tight, because she was wound up tight. My mother was wound up tight. And I was sick a lot when I was a kid. And I was in the hospital down there at Walter Reed up in D.C. where I was born. And I can remember once she was taking me home from the hospital. And I couldn't have been like 4 years old. My feet didn't even reach the end of the front seat. I had a big old 57 Chrysler station wagon, and my feet didn't even reach the end of the seat. And she, you know, she's wound up like this, man. She's got this going on. And we're going up Georgia Avenue, and she pulls into a liquor store that's actually still there. Unbelievably, it's still there. I mean, we're talking, this is like almost 60 years ago. This liquor store is still there. And it's called, it was called the Cork and Bottle. And she left me, she pulled into the parking lot. She left me in the car. And she goes inside, and I could see her through the window. She bought a bottle of whiskey, and she came back out to the car, and she slid behind the driver's wheel, and she peeled that paper bag back, and she cracked that seal. And I'll tell you, my mother couldn't have weighed 100 pounds. I'm sure she didn't even weigh 100 pounds. She tipped that bottle of whiskey up, and she went glug, glug, glug. She about half drained that thing. I mean, it was incredible. And you all know what happened next. You know what happened next. She went from this this. She could just relax. She could just relax. So I witnessed the power of alcohol at an early age. And I can also remember one, I used to just lay awake in bed at night and I'd hear all that arguing and fighting. And one of the things my father would be yelling at my mother, and it wasn't out of anger or hatred, it was just out of frustration. He loved her. They loved each other. They loved each other. But he would yell at her. He'd say, why don't you just stop? Why don't you just stop? I'd be laying awake in bed at night like this. Yeah, man, why don't you just stop? You know, little did I know, I would know the answer to that question in no time at all. It's like, why don't you just stop breathing? Why don't you just not breathe? I needed alcohol to survive. It kept me glued together. Every time I hear somebody tell their AA story, what I'm listening for and what I usually hear is a spiritual story. Because that's what our program of recovery is. You're free to take it or leave it, but and that's not an arrogant take it or leave it. It means our obligation as AA members is to expose fellow sufferers to a solution that's worked for us. Is it the end all be all? Is it the only solution? I don't think so. All I know is it's something that's worked for me. And our 12 steps are a group of principles, and you'll recognize this from the forward to the 12 and 12. A group of principles, spiritual in nature, that when practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to live, to become happily and usefully whole. So you got this kind of being tortured to death by alcohol, this slow, agonizing, excruciatingly painful death. Or you could become happily and usefully whole. You know, I mean, it's kind of like, what do you want to do? I love in the big book where they say, drinking yourself to a, I'm paraphrasing badly, drinking yourself to a horrible alcoholic death or living a life based on spiritual principles are not always easy alternatives to face. And I'm thinking, you know, only for us could that not be an easy alternative. It's like, do you want to be tortured and in pain or do you want to be happy and usefully whole? It's like, anyway. So what our 12 steps do is they bring us to this thing called a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening. And the foundation of AA's program of recovery is that we're not just mentally and physically sick, but that we're spiritually sick. And that's AA's solution. And the way it was presented to me, it was, I was told, we're not selling anything. We're giving it away. It's worked for us. I think it'll work for you, but it's your decision. It's your decision. And that kind of approach worked for me. So whenever I hear somebody tell their AA story, what I'm listening for is a departure from God, or if they never had a relationship with God, an apartness from God. And we know what happens when we're trying to live our lives without God, but we wind up here because we got a really bad manager. And it would be us. I'm managing my own life. What happens when they come back to a God of their understanding? So that's what I always listen for when I listen to an AA story. And my story is no different. My departure from God was a very, there was no gray area. It wasn't over a long period of time or anything like that. I remember the exact day. Now, please be advised that I am not about to engage in any Catholic bashing. I'm not engaging in any religion bashing or church bashing. That's not good AA. That's not what our literature teaches us. So that's not what I'm doing. I'm simply telling my story of my departure from God. And I had been a good little Catholic boy. I went to school every day. And meanwhile, my house is just like a hurricane. I mean, it's just turmoil all the time, nonstop. And so I started acting up in school a little bit. You'd expect that. And at the ripe old age of 10 years old, I was in, this was St. Michael's in Silver Spring, by the way, and I only mention that because you'd be surprised how many people come up to me after meetings and say, I went to that school, and I'm thinking, well, of course you did. You're here in AA. That school cranked out a lot of alcoholics. I mean, I've been hundreds of miles away, and people have said, I went to St. Michael's. So anyway, we were over across the street at the church one day, and I acted up in church, and some of my little buddies snitched on me, and so I got called out by the nun, and when she turned her back, I flipped her off. Now, I didn't even know what that meant, you know? I mean, I'm 10. I just seen some older kids do it. But I learned this really, really fast, that you shouldn't do that. I learned that really fast. And I got yanked out of the church pew, and I literally got dragged across the street by my ear over into the school, which was empty because all the good little boys and girls were still in school. And she took me upstairs to the to our classroom. And here in the classroom, surrounded by pictures of Mary, Jesus, and Joseph, and a nun in full habit, she picks up my desk, she dumps all my books out on the floor, and she says, leave and don't come back. In my little 10-year-old eyes, that was God telling me to leave and don't come back. That's exactly what that was. You know, I didn't know how to make the difference. That was God telling me to leave and don't come back. And I knew something really big had just happened there. I didn't know what, but I knew this was a big deal. I knew this was a big deal. So I can remember walking home with my little backpack with all the books in it, heavy as I don't know what. And with every step I took, I could hear them straps slapping like that. And I'm thinking, man, something big just happened here. I don't know what. Even to this day, I've been sober 38 years. I'm 62 years old. To this day, my mind is just, I'm just still in awe at the swiftness and the completeness of my demise. Because it was at that point, that departure from God, where things started going downhill quick, fast, and in a hurry. I went from being a good little Catholic boy who went to Mass all the time and prayed and all of that to being somebody in a few short years who hated God. I hated God. I don't remember my first drink, but I know this much. I know that whenever it was I took it, and I don't remember, I was like 11 or something like that. By the time I was 11 years old, I was hooking school and coming back home and getting drunk on my father's whiskey and beer. I know that. I wasn't an everyday drunk at 11 years old, but that it wouldn't be that far before I was. But whenever it was I took that first drink, what it did was is it calmed me down. It gave me this artificial sense of peace. There's this historic correspondence between our co-founder, Bill W., and the great Dr. Carl Jung. And I love AA history, and this was the first link in the chain, the run-up to what would become the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the big book, they referred to him as a certain businessman. His name was Roland H. He was a really, really bad drunk, and he went under the care of Dr. Carl Jung for about a year, so we're told, back in the early 30s. Didn't drink, saw the psychiatrist, you know, all the time. And one day he says, okay, man, I think I got this thing. I'm good. So he leaves. He's drunk in no time at all. You all know the story because you read the big book. Probably could quote pages for all I know. Probably tell the story better than I can. But he's drunk in no time at all. And he comes back to Dr. Jung. And he says, you know, why can't I control my drinking? You know, give it to me, Doc. Give it to me straight. I can take it. And I love in the big book where it says, and he did. He told him he was hopeless. He said, I have never, ever seen one single case recover that's got it as bad as you have. Never. This room would be empty tonight if Roland just slumped his shoulders and bowed his head down and said, okay, Doc, thanks, and walked out. We wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be here. But he asked a question that we're all so glad he asked. He said, is there no exception? Are there no exceptions? And Dr. Jung said, yes, there are exceptions. They've been happening since early times. So that means, you know, AA wasn't the first outfit to discover, to have this notion that we're spiritually sick. It's been happening since early times, but those who have found a vital spiritual experience have recovered. And the rest, as they say, is history, because Roland went on to get that spiritual experience. He passed it on to Abby. Abby visited Bill, and we're all sitting here today happy and sober because of that. So that's the notion of needing a spiritual experience to stay sober. 30-some years later, in 1961, Bill and Dr. Jung wrote each other, and Bill wrote a letter to Dr. Jung telling him what, you know, what his part was in the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Dr. Jung sent a letter back, and he agreed with what Bill had said. He said, I remember him, or as you described it, that's what happened. And then he went on to talk a little more. He was talking about Roland, but he meant all alcoholics. And he was talking about how our craving for alcohol is actually craving for spirituality, craving for a union with God. Dr. Jung called it the unrecognized spiritual need, and he said that would lead us into perdition. I had to look up what perdition meant. It ain't good. You don't want to go there. And the unrecognized spiritual need is what did that. The old timer, you know, people who study such things connected the dots a long time ago between people who crave alcohol like we do and who are actually seeking God. They discovered that a long time ago. The old timers in AA had a name for it. They'd call it looking for God in a bottle. Now, if you'd have told me when I was out there drinking that I was looking for God in a bottle, I'd have looked at you like you had two heads. But if you'd have said, I'll bet you're looking for a little peace, aren't you? I'd have said, yes, I am. Yes, I am. Because that's what I had always been looking for, because I was like this inside. Like I said, I felt everything. I understood nothing. I was some kind of twisted up inside. And I know you all understand exactly what I'm talking about. And when I drank alcohol, it gave me that artificial peace. That's exactly what it did. My father died when I was 15 years old. And like a scene out of a movie, on his deathbed, his last words to me were, take care of your mother. Here's how I took care of my mother. I continued to run the streets at night. I got all run all through the juvenile system. I kept winding up in places that ended with Children's Center. Wound up in the Waxler's Children's Center. That was the one in Maryland. I did a lot of ripping and running in D.C. Their juvenile facility was called the Receiving Home. That almost sounds like a nice place, doesn't it? The whole name of it was the Receiving Home for Children. You know, man, I've been in adult jails that weren't as bad as that place. That place was terrible. You know, so I got run all through the juvenile system. I continued to just disappear for days at a time. And I'm a parent and a grandparent today. And I know how that makes a parent feel. They don't know where their children are for days at a time. It's awful. And she was struggling with her own alcoholism. She would have periods of sobriety where she was going to AA, and then she'd go on a drunk. And she had just lost her younger sister, was one of us, and committed suicide. She had just lost her husband. I had an older sister who was an alcoholic who brought a lot of turmoil to the house. And she was just watching the streets swallow up her two sons. So it was hard for her to stay sober. And I want to tell you this. Right now, I don't judge anybody who returns to drinking. I really, really don't. There used to be an old timer that would go to the meetings I went to, and he would say, it's really very simple. This ain't rocket science. You either want to be sober more than you want to be drunk, or you want to be drunk more than you want to be sober. Of course, I wanted to be just like him, so I would say the same thing. You know, yeah, it's simple. Either you want to be drunk more than you want to be sober, or you want to be sober more than you want to be drunk. You know? Today I consider that an arrogant statement, and I would never say that. I've had alcoholics who I've tried to help literally die in my arms, who I knew wanted to be sober more than anything in the world. I know they wanted to be sober more than anything in the world. I don't know why some of us get it and some of us don't. I really, really don't. I just don't. So I don't judge anybody who returns to drinking. So anyway, those were my father's last words to me. When I was 17 years old, my mother went on a drunk to end all drunks, and she just moved. I don't want to make it sound like she left me. I could have gone with her, but at this point, I'm a full-blown alcoholic, and I ain't interested in going with her. So she went back to where she was from, up in Minnesota. And I hit the streets. And you know, I'm the kind of drunk, I've been shot at, stabbed, I've been beat so bad I couldn't walk. I've been in jails from here to Florida, and I spent a lot of my drinking on the streets. And when I say on the streets, I don't mean sleeping in some nice little homeless shelter with a color TV and a washer and dryer. I mean sleeping in the woods, sleeping in parking garage stairwells, sleeping in your car if you left it unlocked. I used to just walk down the street pulling on car door handles, man, whichever one opened up, that's where I'd spend the night. That was always good for some surprised looks on people's faces in the morning. I don't know if any of y'all remember that TV show Taxi, but my favorite character on that show was Jim. For obvious reasons, anybody that knows the show, Jim was a lot like us. You know, he just kind of wasn't all there. And I had hair back in those days, and I was a lot like Jim. And I'd pop up out of the back seat when somebody get in their car like that, probably have leaves in my hair, and I'd say, "Good morning." And they'd freak out, and that would give me a chance to split. And I don't say any of this like I'm trying to impress anybody in here. Lord knows I'm in the wrong room if I'm trying to impress anybody in here. I know that's right. I know that's right. When I look into y'all's eyes and I think of the collective life experience in this room and I think of the collective suffering in this room, ain't nothing I'm saying is going to impress you. This I know. And I'm sure not saying this stuff like I think I'm going to make you think I'm some sort of tough guy. Because we know that ain't true. There's some real tough guys in this room. You know who you are. I mean, there's people in this room could kick my butt without breaking a sweat. Nothing but sirs be coming out of my, yes sir, no sir. I mean, that's just the way it is, you know. So I'm not saying any of this to make you think like I'm some sort of tough guy. My friend Ross, he says, "Mike, you ain't got to tell people you ain't a tough guy. My God, they can look at you and they can tell that. I mean, they check you off the list as a threat the second they laid eyes on you." I said, "Well, I know that, Ross, but I don't want them to think that I think I'm a tough guy." He said, "Man, you're thinking too much." And that may be true. That may be true. But that was just my drinking. That's the way I went at it. I went hard and heavy. I hit the ground running. I went full tilt from day one, and I never looked back. I drank for one reason and one reason only, and that was to get fallen down drunk. I started, you know, blacking out, and being a fallen down drunk happened right from the very beginning. I had some exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was a kid, too. Two things. One is I came home from school one day when I was a kid, and there were two women back in the bedroom with my mother. Y'all know that painting, the man on the bed. This was like the woman on the bed. I got home like maybe 9 years old. I tiptoed down the hall. I hear these women talking to her back in there, and they're talking to her in a way I ain't never heard anybody talk to her before. And then I heard some laughter. You know, man, it had been a long time since there was any laughter in that house. And they had like a little care package. You know, they had some fruit and some orange juice and stuff like that, and they were feeding her and talking to her. And I remember when they left, I didn't want them to leave. And I remember running to the window and peeking through the blinds when they got back in their car to leave. And I remember wishing one of them would turn around and look at me, but they never did. They never did. And I've never forgot that. I never forgot that. Of course, what I was witnessing was one of the most powerful things in Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12-step call. And years later, when I got sober, I can remember I went on a lot of 12-step calls with my sponsor, and he would like be giving me instructions. You know, this is what you say, this is what you do, this is what you look for, and all that sort of stuff. And every time I was in a house, I was always very aware of who else was in the house, especially if there were any children in the house. And if there were, I'd always try to make eye contact with them and give them a wink or a thumbs up, a smile, something, anything. And whenever we walked back out to the car, I always looked back at the house, and at least half the time there'd be a little face in the window. I've never forgotten that. So I witnessed the power of Alcoholics Anonymous at an early age also. And I also went to a meeting once with my mother, around the same age, around 9. And it was a speaker's meeting in Silver Spring. It used to be held in the rec center at Jessup Blair Park there at the corner of Georgia and Eastern. Anybody familiar with the neighborhood? And the thing I remember about the meeting is everybody seemed happy. And, you know, these people told their stories. And I remember some of the things they said. It was kind of funny. It kind of a good vibe in the room. But it's what happened after the meeting that I'll never forget. These two women came up to me after the meeting, And they started saying things to me like, oh, honey, don't you worry about your mother's drinking. She's nothing. Now, I'm thinking they were just trying to make me feel better. Like, you know, your mom can get well. Don't you worry about it. I'm guessing that's what they were thinking. But it wasn't working that way. I mean, because they kept saying that. And then they started like bragging about their own drinking. And I'm thinking, well, first of all, y'all don't know her like I do. You know, and then the other thing I noticed was my mother was standing behind them. And she had this look on her face like, see, I told you I'm not that bad. Fast forward 10 years. I'm 19 years old. I've been living on the streets for a couple of years. I'm a full-blown alcoholic. I'm living in that park where that rec center was, where that meeting had been all those years ago. And that's where I was when I learned that my mother had died a lonely alcoholic death in an apartment 1,000 miles away in Minneapolis. And I looked over at that building and I remembered that night and I thought to myself, she wasn't that bad, huh? I bet y'all are still sober and she's dead. You know who drinks themselves to death? Housewives who hide their half pints in the hamper. Guys who've never lost a job. You know, they're the ones that drink themselves to death because they're not that bad. They're not that bad. When I got here, we might be sick, but we ain't stupid. I knew what I was. You know, I wasn't one of these people that says, oh, I was the last to know. Man, I knew what I was, and I knew what happened to people who drank like I did, but I had no alternative. I was condemned to death if I continued drinking, but I couldn't stay glued together without it. That's a place we all know, isn't it? That's a place we all know. I was never really overtly suicidal. I just kind of walked around wishing I was dead a lot. Like if some space junk just fell out of the sky and hit me in the head and I was dead, that'd be fine with me, or you know, whatever. That'd be great. And but you know, I was never really overtly suicidal. I think there was something deep down inside of me that wanted to live. You know, I mean, I wasn't scared of dying. Well, I might have been scared of dying, but I wasn't scared of being dead. I was way more scared of living than I was of dying. But there was something deep down inside of me, like a little glow that wanted to live. And everybody in this room had that, or you wouldn't be here. It might have been obscured with alcohol and mental illness, emotional illness, and whatever else we're pumping into our bodies. But that glow had to be there. It had to be there. I really wanted to know what was the matter with me. I knew there was something wrong with me, but I just didn't know what it was. I wanted to know what's the matter with me. And apparently other people wanted to know what was the matter with me too. I don't know about y'all, but I used to hear this all the time. What's the matter with you? My God, anybody ever hear that? Of course you have. What's the matter with you? We hear a lot of the same things, don't we? Like, you did what? You did what? Or, no, you didn't. Or, here's my favorite. Well, one of my favorites. Like, what were you thinking? I don't know what I was thinking. So I really wanted to know what was the matter with me. And I would just like walk out across it. Like I said, I wasn't overtly suicidal, but across the street from this park was a liquor store called Morris Miller. And Georgia Avenue is a busy road, man. It's a busy road. But I would just walk right on out there without looking. I heard a guy telling his story once. He said, I was a directing traffic kind of drunk. Yeah, I didn't look at it that way, but I was a directing traffic kind of drunk, too. And I used to just walk out into Georgia Avenue without even looking. And I'd hear the brakes come on. And you know what I heard? What's the matter with you? I don't know. I haven't got a clue what's happening. I wound up my oldest sister, there was one member of the family who was not an alcoholic, my oldest sister, and she was always more like a mother than a sister to me, and she got as far away from this crazy family as she could get. She went all the way out to Los Angeles, and I was like the little brother from you know what. I showed up on her doorstep, and she tried to help me. She really did, and I treated her just like I did my mother. I mean, I wasn't mean and nasty. I didn't like hit her or anything like that, but I stole from her. I stole money from her. I stole her peace of mind. I just worried her to death, and she finally kicked me out. And I can remember, I can't fight, by the way. I'm just not good at it. You know, it's not like I was scared. It's not like I didn't have any heart. I would try, but I just wasn't very good at it. My fights were like of the two-hit variety, where you would hit me and I would hit the ground. You know, I mean, that's just the way it was. And I was a pretty easy to get going guy, I thought. But when I would get drunk, I must have got a little mouthy because people would practice on me. You know, so I was always getting in drunks with glasses. Oh, man, it's hard if you're a drunk with glasses, man. All the time I'm waking up like this, knots on my head, and like, where am I? And I'm blind as a bat without my glasses, too. But so I'd been beat up, and I was about half drunk. And I remember standing in the middle of her living room, and I'm just swaying like this. And I remember tears just streaming down her face, And she begged me, literally begged me, to tell her why I was doing this to myself. Why are you doing this to yourself? And I probably said the most honest thing I'd said in my whole life. I said, I don't know. I don't know, but I know this much, I can't stop. And I don't mean I can't stop like, oh, I've tried to quit drinking, but I can't. I've never tried to quit drinking. Why would I? It was the only thing keeping me glued together. I mean, life was intolerable without it. I don't dare stop. That's what I meant by I can't stop. We just rip the hearts out of the people who are unfortunate enough to love us. And the way we hurt them is we force them to watch us commit slow motion suicide. And I've been on both sides of that. I've been the one doling out the pain, and I've been the one observing the pain. It's deep. It's deep. Cunning, baffling, and powerful has a scorched earth, take no prisoners kind of attitude. It really, really does. It really does. So that's the box I was in. I can remember, you know, my history as a criminal is like extremely petty. You know, I have no Al Capone. My customary charges were things like disorderly conduct, or apparently I liked the sound of breaking glass when I was drunk, so it would be destruction of property. You know, really heavy charges like that. You know, the longest I ever spent in jail was like 3 months at one stretch. I mean, it was in and out a lot, but just never for long periods of time, because I was just really not much of a criminal. And but I was out in L.A., and I'd been living on the streets for a while, and I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired of being broken. And I decided I was going to rob a liquor store. And I knew where I could get a gun, so I got one. And I'd been in a liquor store that had been robbed once, so I felt like I had training. And the liquor store I was in, it was in D.C., this guy came in, he just got a six-pack out of the cooler, he went up to the cash register, and I was behind him in line, and I saw some money drop down to the floor. So I picked the money up, and I'm tapping him on the shoulder, and he just keeps going like this. I said, man, you dropped some money, and he keeps going like that. I went, what is wrong with this guy? And he turned around, he was significantly taller than me, and he had like a little chrome pistol, and I remember he just paused and looked at me, and the pistol's pointing dead in my chest, and he's looking at me like, you idiot, can't you see I'm robbing this place? And I'm like this after that. And he went out the door, and I didn't even look. I'm looking straight ahead like that. I wasn't going to look. He might shoot me. And the guy behind the cash register, he'd been robbed so many times, this didn't bother him at all. He's on the phone with the police, and he's keeping the line moving and making change out of his pocket. But I'm like this. So anyway, I had training, and I'd scoped out a liquor store that I was going to rob, and I was wearing my father's field jacket from Korea. It was older than I was, and it was all tore up, and I had the pistol in one pocket, and I had $2 in the other pocket. And so I go into the liquor store, and I walk over. There was nobody in there, just the guy behind the cash register. I went over, and I got a six-pack of beer like I saw my mentor do, and I came up, and I set it on the counter, and I noticed a couple things right away. The first thing I noticed was the guy behind the counter was huge. My God, this guy had to be about 6'5", 260 pounds, and none of it was fat. And I'm like, oh, man. So that kind of got me to thinking a little bit right there. I'm glad I was only half drunk. And then there was a sign taped to the back of the cash register that said, mandatory 5-year prison sentence for any crime committed with a handgun in the state of California. And I'm thinking, dang, God, prison? You know, I'll do a little county time and stuff like that, but prison? 5 years? No. Now I'm really getting jaundiced. I'm thinking, like, you know, don't they have like San Quentin out here? You know, no, I'm thinking this ain't a good idea. And so I'm just standing there, and finally, a few seconds goes by, and the guy leans over and he goes, anything else? You know, and I just went like that, and I'm like, gun, $2, and I just took the $2 out and I threw it on the counter, and I said, and give me a pack of Cools. Tell you how long ago this was, I got change back from $2 for a six-pack and a pack of cigarettes. So you know that ain't happening anymore. And so I went out on the beach with my little wounded pride, and I'm thinking, man, I'm just berating myself. You ain't a good guy. You ain't a bad guy. You're just nothing. You can't even rob a liquor store. What's the matter with you? You ought to just take that gun and shoot yourself. And I've never been overtly suicidal, but this is looking like a good idea at this point. It really, really is. To this day, I don't believe I really wanted to, but I just started messing around. I pulled the pistol out of my pocket, and I remember putting the barrel to the side of my head. And even though it was a double-action revolver, I guess for a dramatic effect, I pulled the hammer back with my thumb and I had my finger on the trigger. And I got like this moment of clarity. This, you know, a couple of thoughts occurred to me right away. One of them was that this could be dangerous, what you're doing. But the other one was, it was like, is this really what you want to do? Is this really what you want to do? I was 19 years old. Is this how you wanted to end? You wanted to end right here and now? And there was a darkness inside of me that kept saying, do it. Pull the trigger. You can make this all go away. You can make it all stop now. But there was another part of me that kept saying, No. I don't want it to end like this. And I'm here to tell you it has nothing to do with guts. I cringe when I hear somebody say they didn't have the guts to kill themselves. That's not doesn't factor into the equation. We're built to want to live. There's no shame in that. There's no shame in it. It has nothing to do with guts. I used to say at this point in my story that it was only by God's grace that I didn't pull the trigger. That may be true. I don't know. One night I was telling my story, and there were a brother and sister who were both in the program who I just loved to death. St. Michael's alumni, now that I think about it. And as those words tumbled out of my mouth, that it was only by God's grace that I didn't pull the trigger, I was looking at them, and there was nothing in their body language or the looks on their faces that made me think I had said something wrong. But the fact was, their brother had shot himself in the head a couple of years earlier. He was one of us. And I thought to myself, what am I saying about their brother? That he didn't get God's grace? That he doesn't count? And so what I've decided is, I'm not smart enough to figure that out. I'm just not. One of the things I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is there's not a shred of spiritual arrogance in our literature. One of my favorite lines in the Big Book is where it says, we realize we know only a little. We realize we know only a little. One of the things I also used to say was that it's only by God's grace I didn't kill myself or anybody else. I take a meeting to the state prison in Hagerstown. Probably about a third of the guys in the room are responsible for killing somebody, whether it was a outright homicide or whether it was a car accident or whatever. You know, about a third of the guys in the room are, have killed somebody. What am I saying to them if I say it's only by God's grace that I didn't kill myself or anybody else? They didn't get God's grace. They don't count. They don't matter. So I just stopped saying that. I just don't say that anymore. I don't know why some of us pull the trigger and some of us don't. I don't know why some of us get this thing and some of us don't. I've been to a lot of funerals over the last 38 years, trust me. And I've been with people who I know wanted this thing more than anything in the world. So I'm just totally out of that debate at this point. I don't judge anybody who returns to drinking, and I don't judge anybody who pulls the trigger. It's just, that's above my pay grade. I don't know. My heart just breaks for them and for their families because I know the pain. I know how much it hurts. So I continued on my miserable way for a few more years. I had about 5 more years of drinking to do, and we know it never gets better. It only gets worse. I've managed to make my way back east here. And when I reached out for help, the hand of AA was there. I had a great career going at the car wash. And when apparently they felt like it was safe to let me wash things. In the 60s, I was a dishwasher at the Tasty Diner. And in the late 70s, when I came to AA, I was washing cars in Langley Park. So when I got to my A step, it was great. When you start at the bottom and stay there, your A step list is a little shorter, so there's advantages there. Nobody wanted to marry me, so I didn't have a family or a wife. And nobody else's wife wanted anything to do with me, so I didn't bust up any families. And you can see from my career that there wasn't a lot of upward mobility. So it's not like I was stepping on people on my way to the top, you know, this blind ambition. So anyway, I had a great career going at the car wash. And when I wasn't sleeping in the woods next to the car wash, I was sleeping on the floor of a cockroach-infested room in Langley Park, Maryland with a couple other drunks. And this is the condition I was in when I reached out for help. The hand of AA showed up driving a 1975 Chevrolet. The guy driving it was a man named Dan O, a guy who had become my sponsor and remained my sponsor for over 30 years until he passed away in 2009. Had a guy riding shotgun named Bob A, who had just got out of the nut house. Dan left Bob in the car, and he gets out of the car, and he approaches my building, and he opens up the door to the hallway, and he's hit with the stench of urine and stale booze and probably some wacky weed floating around the hallway, and he climbs some dirty stairs, and he knocks on this brown, dented-up metal door. And I opened that door, and he stuck his hand out, and he said, "Hi, I'm Dan. I'm an alcoholic." And like I said, we might be sick, but we ain't stupid. I ain't never had a problem saying that. I knew what I was. This was not. I was in a nut house once, where they diagnosed me as a whole bunch of other things, and they told me straight up to my face that I was not an alcoholic. They found me in a parking lot, by the way. I was living in a gravel parking lot behind a beer bar in L.A., corner of Lincoln and Washington. And if somebody saw me, thought I needed medical attention, I didn't argue with them, so I wound up in this nut house. And I loved the place. They fed us, and we got to drink coffee, and there were Betty Boop cartoons in the morning at the little black and white TV down the hallway. We'd go to our little group therapy, and we'd take our meds like that. And I just loved this place. And I swear, they would have us do calisthenics. You had a bunch of psych patients on meds, and they'd say, "Okay, everybody, touch your toes," and it'd be like bowling pins falling over. And sometimes I think when they were feeling a little devilish, they would throw a volleyball out there and watch it. They'd have these long dissertations of whether it was in or out. It was just incredible. But I took a bunch of tests in there. All I remember is they were from Minnesota. I said something from Minnesota. I'm sure there's probably some people in here have taken those same tests. But anyway, so it comes to the time to find out what was the matter with me, because I really always wanted to know. And I go in the room. There's a table like this where there's three chairs on this side, and there's one chair there. And that's where I was sitting, kind of a lot like a parole hearing. And they said, well, first of all, Mike, you're not an alcoholic. I had to remind them they found me in a parking lot. You know, now, in fairness to the mental health community, this was over 40 years ago. I don't think they would make that mistake today. They said, you're not an alcoholic because you're too young. That's what they told me. I have 5 more years to go. And so right then and there, I knew more than they did. Right then and there, I just leaned back and I said, okay, so what's wrong with me? And they said, well, what you have is severe, emphasis on severe, emotional problems. I'm like, well, no kidding. You went to school for that? And they said, and when we straighten out those emotional problems, your drinking will straighten out. And I knew more than they did right then. And now I wound up cashing my disability check in a bar. So he knocks on the door and I open it up. He sticks his hand out. He says, hi, I'm Dan. I'm an alcoholic. And I stuck my hand out. I said, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. The instant that our hands touched, I became part of a chain reaction that started in Akron, Ohio in 1935 when two drunks discovered they could do together what they could not do by themselves. I love AA history, and I can talk about it for hours, but I'd probably be standing out there by myself if I was talking about AA history for hours. So the short version is them two went looking for a third one, them three went looking for a fourth one, and here we are over 80 years later with millions upon millions of recoveries around the world. Here we are. Doing the same thing they were doing way back then. AA always has been and always will be. One drunk helping another. And whether they say it or not, there's an understanding that they need each other. They need each other. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. And that's what began to happen. One of my favorite parts of our history, and you all know about it, it's when the man that Bill would call his sponsor for the rest of his life, Ebby T., paid a visit to a stinking drunk on gin, Bill W., 182 Clinton Streets, November 1934. Bill hadn't drawn a sober breath in I don't know how long. And his friend Ebby, who used to be a really bad drunk, comes to pay a visit to him. And on this day, the man who would struggle with his sobriety the rest of his life, but eventually would die sober. But on this day, Ebby's the one clean. He's the one sober. He's dressed nice. His eyes are clear. And the man who would write such iconic words is, rarely have we seen a person fail. He's so stinking drunk on gin, he can't see straight. He hasn't been able to shave. His hands are shaking like this. And Ebby makes the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. I've listened to Bill in old talks describe that scene many different ways. But one of the most eloquent ways he ever described that interaction was something he wrote in 1954. Anybody that knows Bill's writings, one of his metaphors is caves. Alcoholics, you know, living in their dark caves. You know, they'll go back to their caves. And so his description of that scene was that everybody else was on the outside looking in. Everybody else was on the outside looking in. But Ebby, having had been a recent dweller in the strange world of alcoholism, was able to enter the dark cave he was in and take him by the hand and lead him out into the light. That's what we do. That's what AA is. That's what was beautiful. So it ain't Brooklyn, New York. It ain't 1934, and his name ain't Ebby. His name's Dan, and he's putting me in the back seat of a 1975 Chevrolet. But what he was doing was reaching his hand out and leading me from darkness into light. And Dan and Bob did exactly what they were supposed to do. They told me a little of their stories. That's why we tell our story. So you'll know I know. When I was at that nut house out in L.A., there was this one counselor, therapist, whatever you want to call him, who I believe probably really did care about me. And the walls started to come down just a little bit. But when it came time to get real, I couldn't do it. I said, don't tell him nothing. Number one, he won't understand. And number two, he just doesn't care. You know? Might not have been true, might have been fair to him. I think he probably really did care. But that's how I felt, so nobody else could get through to me. I could have had Dr. Jung, William James, I could have had Father Ann, I could have had the best people in the world sitting across the table from me, telling me exactly what my problem is. I can't hear them. But I can hear you. I can hear you. So they did exactly what they were supposed to do. Dan's telling me this story about crawling around on his hands and knees, barking like a dog, biting anybody that would come near him. That's just like what we do while the cops are getting ready to give him some knowledge knots. And Bob A. apparently had just gotten out of the nut house for trying to kill somebody. And it's amazing who you feel safe with. I feel safe with these people, you know. And what they were doing is they were drawing me into this miracle that had already happened. And I can remember when I had been so angry at God all those years, I had done, like, to me, just terrible things. I broke into the church I got thrown out of. I stole money from the poor box because I figured I was poor. I would go in on Saturday afternoons when people were standing in line waiting to go to confession and panhandle from them. I would, you know, the people that light the candles and they sit there and they do some prayers like in a Catholic. I would go up and wait for them to turn around. I'd say, man, you got a quarter? Yeah, I mean, it was terrible. And, you know, the bell ringers at Christmas time, I would harass them to the point where I got locked up a couple times for doing that. I thought I hated God. By the time I got to AA, all of that had been beaten out of me, I was just like bewildered on steroids, you know. I mean, I was just bewildered. I didn't know what to believe. And so when they started talking about God, I got like, uh-oh. And I told them straight up. I said, y'all don't know what I've done to God. And Dan said, he just laughed. He said, you can't hurt God, Mike. He said, if you can hurt God, you need a bigger God. And I said, okay, well, I like that. And then he said, he said, being angry at God is not such a bad place to be. I said, it's not. He said, no. He said, you can't be angry at something you don't believe in. I thought, damn, never looked at it that way before. I said that a lot in those early days. Never looked at it that way before. And then he said something else. He said, those that are the most angry at God are those that are the most hurt at not being able to find him. And I knew that hit me right between the eyes. I knew that was true. That was true for me. So I don't know about y'all, but I have been told all my life that I was useless. There's no good. My parents didn't talk to me like that. They were good people. They loved me. They wouldn't have talked to me like that. But everybody else did. Teachers, judges, probation officers, cops, neighbors, you know, passerbys in the street. You're useless. You're no good. You'll never amount to anything. In 1971, I was standing in front of a judge in Washington, D.C. at the courthouse there at 5th and E. The purpose of the hearing was to see if I was going to be allowed to go home before trial, which I knew wasn't going to happen since I didn't have a home. The thing I remember about that day was not one single person looked at me. Not one. Nobody in that courtroom made eye contact with me. Not the judge, not the state's attorney, not my own public defender. It was clear to me that nobody in that room cared about me. I felt like nobody in that building, nobody in that city. I felt like nobody on the planet cared about me. And when they turned me around and take me back to the cell block, I remember thinking to myself, maybe they're all right. You are useless. You are no good. You're getting what you deserve. Wasn't true, but that's what I believed. In the back seat of that 1975 Chevrolet, not even to my first meeting yet, Dan said words to me that changed my life forever, and I've never been the same since. He said, Mike, what we've learned is that we're sick people. We're not bad people. And the next words he said to me made me just rock back in the seat, and tears started streaming down my face, and I ain't ashamed to say it. He said, we're sick people, not bad people, and you're worth saving. You're worth saving. It's like I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Those words just busted open a hole in my chest, and the oxygen of God's love just came in there and started feeding that glow that I was talking about earlier that we all have to have had. And I could feel it just getting stronger and stronger and stronger. I didn't have a spiritual experience like Bill W. did, you know, the room getting all white and the wind not of air but of grace, and so this is the God of the preachers. But it also wasn't the slow educational variety either. It was very intense, and it was over a period of hours and days, not even weeks or months. It was over a period of hours and days where I knew something was changing inside of me. I could literally feel the love in the room. Sometimes you hear people when they're telling their story say, oh, I hated you people, and I hated these meetings, and I hated your stupid steps. I'm thinking, well, drink a little more. You'll reconsider. Trust me. I didn't get here too early. I just didn't get here too early. That's my problem. Sometimes people act like, oh, I'm hard-headed. Took me a bunch. That ain't hard-headed. That's just getting here too soon. That's all. That's all that is. You know, you stay out there till you're done. This place is going to look pretty good. This place is going to look pretty good. And it looked good to me. I could tell by looking in your eyes. You people knew me. You could finish my sentences. You knew how I felt inside. I'd never been anywhere where people understood. And then you presented the solution to me. You presented the 12 steps of AA. You told me that if I worked them to the best of my ability, that I would achieve this thing called a spiritual experience, and it would expel the obsession to drink. I would be free, and I would know happiness like I've never known. Happy is cool. We like happy. And when you're crawling out of the woods, happy is pretty darn good. But it's much more than that. You get to actually experience joy. You get to experience worth, being an instrument of God's will and being able to make a difference in other people's lives. That's what you get to experience. That's what we cannot miss. When I was sober just a couple of weeks, two big things happened to me. One was, I was sober about 3 weeks, and we're out at the Riverdale Club in PG County up there in Maryland. And this guy comes in to meet, and he's even newer than I am. You know, I'm still doing this, you know, but he's even newer than I am. And Dan says to me, he says, go over and talk to him. I look at him like he's crazy. I said, well, what am I going to tell him? He says, you've been sober for 3 weeks, haven't you? I said, yeah. He said, well, you go tell him how you did it. Well, okay. So I shuffle on across the room. I'm like, hi, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. He stuck his hand out. He said, whoever he was an alcoholic. The instant that our hands touched, I ceased being a useless human being. There was nothing in my heart but to try to show this guy how I stayed sober for 3 weeks. I haven't been a useless human being since that day. Another thing that happened in that exact same room, and I'll finish with this because I know y'all thinking, hey, am I just guy going to shut up? But, is I've been sober a couple of months, and I was at a noon meeting. And back then, you smoked in the meetings. There was like an ashtray every 12 inches, you know. And there's a long table like that, and everybody's smoking. And I'm just sort of scanning the table, and everybody's hands got a cigarette in them. Some of them are shaking. Some of them aren't. Everybody's cutting designs into their styrofoam cup with their thumbnail. That just must be like an AA thing, I guess. And I stopped at this one set of hands that belonged to a young woman. She couldn't have been 20 years old. And the reason I stopped at her hands is I noticed her wrists were bandaged. And so I looked up into her eyes, and there was just nothing there. I mean, there was just nothing there. It was just like she was dead inside. And I knew how that felt. I knew exactly how she felt inside. And I looked at the woman next to her, and the woman next to her was older, sober, and I don't know if she was her sponsor or at least somebody who brought her to the meeting. But the way the older woman had her arm draped around the young girl's chair, her wrists were facing outward like that, and I noticed these jagged scars on her wrists. And I couldn't put it into words then, but I knew what I was witnessing is what AA is. It's what binds us together. It's the great suffering and the great love. The great suffering and the great love. Well, if Dave was here, I would thank him for asking me to come down here. Dave's not here, is he? He ain't here. Well, thank you, Dave, and thank you all for listening and keeping me sober tonight.
Thank you.